This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour, the week in review.
Hello there. Welcome to the Trumpet's weekly review of the important news of this past week. I'm Joel Hilliker, and with me is our panel here in the studio. We have Jeremiah Jacques.
Thanks for having me.
And Andrew Miller.
Hello.
We're a little more crowded than usual because we have a man we're usually watching on a Skype connection from Jerusalem who's with us here in the studio today, Brent Nachtigall.
Hello.
And from our office in Britain, we have Richard Palmer.
Good afternoon.
So we're going to start with news about a couple of elections this week, first in Israel, then in Spain. Israel's election on Tuesday has left the nation in a state of uncertainty, one that could take quite a while to sort out. We spoke with this with Brent on Wednesday's program. We're going to go back to him now to catch up with how the situation is playing out. Brent.
So as we discussed on Wednesday's show, the election turned out to be quite a stalemate between the two leading parties, blue and white, Benny Gantz's party. He was the leading vote getter. It looks like he's going to get 33 seats in the next Knesset, and Likud, led by Mr. Netanyahu, is going to get 31. And so in this, the way that Israel makes up its government, you have to get 61 seats to have the majority in the Knesset. And so you have to form some type of coalition with other parties and other parties that have their own interests at stake or in it. And Israel, as we've covered before, is incredibly varied in its populace, religious parties, secular parties, right-wing parties, peacenik parties, Arab parties, and they're all trying to vie for these 61 votes. And so what it's come down to now, it seems, is you have a right-wing bloc, including Mr. Netanyahu, that can get about 55, and then a left-wing bloc that can get about 55 as well. Both of them can't make the 61 vote threshold count threshold. And so there's a number of ways this can go forward. It looks like it could go back to a third election in another couple of months to try and shake it up again and see what happens. It doesn't seem like many people want that, though, and so there's going to be some very big political wrangling that takes place. The biggest thing that came out of the last couple of days is Netanyahu has stated that he is going to form, or he does form, a one bloc, including the religious parties and the right-wing parties, and that they are going to act as one in negotiations. So this means that he has taken Likud, his party, to expanded that now so that he is the voice for 55 seats. So hopefully he'll get the opportunity to be the first one to try and crack some heads together and form a coalition. And that's what the president is going to decide on Sunday. Reuven Rivlin, according to the Israel's Democracy, the president decides who has the best chance to form a coalition, and he will give that man 6 weeks to come up with a coalition, to come up with the 61 seats, bargaining with the other groups. And if he fails to do that, then somebody else will have a go for 2 weeks, and if that fails, again, we'll be going back to elections.
How much leverage does Netanyahu have as opposed to Benny Gantz, in your opinion?
It's really interesting because if you read the media or if you listen to the media and read the press in Israel, you would have come away from this election saying that it was horrible for Netanyahu and it was great for Gantz. But if you look at the figures, Gantz has just as a difficult task to producing a government as Netanyahu does. It's very difficult for both. You have one, Avigdor Lieberman again. He got 9 seats this time, and he has kind of said that he doesn't want Netanyahu to lead, and so he would like Likud and Gantz's party to come together without Netanyahu involved. But Likud has said they're going to keep Netanyahu, so there's going to be no way of that happening. But he won't be in a government that includes the Arab parties, Lieberman. And that was the thing that Gantz was maybe hoping for, that he might be included in the Arab parties in his coalition. Anyway, basically right now, it looks like it would go back to a third election, barring some huge compromises that to this point, nobody has been willing to make. But again, I think if you listen to the press and even to the lead up of the election, and the aftermath, this was a resounding defeat for Netanyahu. Again, he can't form a coalition either, but it's hard to see how the nation goes forward without him as well.
Let's just talk about the trumpet brief that Brad McDonald wrote yesterday. He was basically talking about how much resistance Benjamin Netanyahu faces within his country, despite the fact that he's been, in so many ways, such a successful leader over the past decade. He detailed some of the factors that have given Israelis, made them resistant to continuing his rule for a while. I guess what I'm wondering is how much the press... You're talking about just how negative the reportage of the election itself has been. How much of a role has the press played in prejudicing people against him? And I guess how much of a parallel do we see in Israel with, say, what's happened within the United States and within Britain?
Right. I think there is a direct parallel to what's happening here. It's interesting because one of the things that the population that voted against him has against him is he's, you know, got these charges laid against him for bribery and such. And if you look at some of those charges, what were they about? They were about him trying to get some positive press. So he was going around the back of the typical way of kind of the independency of the press to try and make sure that he has a positive outlet there, listen, like giving some pro Netanyahu stances, because it just doesn't exist. Even this is something that our editor-in-chief noticed when he visited Israel. I guess it was about 10 months ago or something like that, 8 months ago. I got a copy of the Jerusalem Post for him, put it on his table, and then he came later on that day and he's like, when did the Jerusalem Post go leftist? When did the radical left get a hold of the Jerusalem Post? Because they never used to be that way, and yet he could perceive it kind of straight off the bat that they're anti-Netanyahu as well, and they're not afraid to show that. Even some of the other editors of the Times of Israel, I'd say, Horowitz, he used to be one of the editors of the Jerusalem Post. He left, came out with his own outfit, looked like it was going to be great. Their opinion and analysis has been against Netanyahu. All you have right now is Israel Hayom. And that's the newspaper that Netanyahu tried to do a deal with to try and get some more positive press. But they are basically the only outlet, it seems, those that are associated with Israel Hayom that are pro-Netanyahu. And there is this really good article in Israel Hayom today, and it talks about what Mr. McDonald was writing about in his Trump brief. And I'll just quote this for you. It says, there are many simplified reasons why he must be defeated, that is Netanyahu, but in the end there is a global cultural message that has invested all of the chattering classes. His profile in the eyes of the European Union, the United Nations, and the US Democrats, in short, an international cultural society led by the left from Hollywood to Rome, is annoyingly tied to somebody that they don't like. They're the globalists, they say, this writer says, the environmentalists, the feminists, the LGBT, anti-imperialist, anti-racist, and white elite are against Bibi. So the same educated political class that's against Boris Johnson, against Brexit, let's put it that way, against the president of the United States, is against Netanyahu from ruling. And so you get this outsized opinion, what you think it's a majority opinion in the nation, when really it's just the press and those that have a voice shouting really loudly against him. And yet there is still a lot of support for Mr. Netanyahu amongst Israelis.
So if we just back away from, say, the rough and tumble politics of what's happening here, and we just evaluate what is the moment that Israel is facing right now in the prophetic context, the bigger picture, what do you expect from Israel in the time ahead?
Well, I don't think that we can bet against Mr. Netanyahu just because we have seen President Trump come through a similar type of onslaught in the election here in the United States.
He is a fighter.
He is a fighter, and in many ways, you know, people, I would say, Mr. Netanyahu is probably a little bit more sophisticated in terms of the way he speaks than Mr. Trump, but he's still straight talking. And he does have broad consensus amongst those people that are worried most for Israel's security, that care about the American-Israeli relationship. They like where it's going with Mr. Trump. And looking at Bible prophecy too, it seems that there is going to be a continued close relationship between the United States and Israel. And sometimes it's personality that brings together those relationships, and the relationship that Netanyahu has with President Trump is quite strong.
Well, we are going to talk a little bit more about the relationship between America and Israel in the second half of the program, so do stick around for that. In the meantime, please go to thetrumpet.com and check out Brad McDonald's article from yesterday, Why Israel's Radical Left Hates Bibi Netanyahu. He makes some very interesting points, and we see more and more of these parallels between what's happening in the United States and Britain and Israel, these three nations that are linked together so forcefully within Bible prophecy. It shows that the fate of these three nations is linked. So to see these parallel trends playing out within these nations is quite fascinating. We do appreciate that very much, Brent. And again, we will stay tuned to that story. This was Israel's second election this year. Well, Spain is also set to have its second election this year. Never the sign of a healthy government. To learn about what Spain's political difficulties tell us, we'll go to our man in Britain, Richard Palmer.
Yes, Spain is having a whole lot of electoral turmoil, and this is not really a short-term trend. This is their fourth election they're going for now in 4 years. They can't seem to get a stable government together. And if you've been listening to this show for any length of time, you might be thinking this sounds familiar. And it does, because we end up talking about this for country after country after country within Europe, where these different countries have not been able to have a stable government. To summarize some of the recent history, in December 2015, Spain held elections. They were inconclusive. They weren't able to form any governments. So they ended up having another vote in the spring of 2016. That they did manage to put together a coalition. That fell apart in a corruption scandal in 2018. A new government came together, but it was really unstable. It tottered on for a few months. It fell. We had a vote in April. Nobody after that vote in April could come together with a working coalition. So now the clock has kind of run out on their amount of time. They've spent all of that time since April trying to come up with a coalition. They haven't managed it. Now we're having fresh elections in November. Now, right at the heart of what we're seeing here is, believe it or not, an event that happened over a decade ago, the 2008 financial crisis. And I think the fact that it is still causing political turmoil 11 years later just shows what a massive blow that crisis did to the credibility of mainstream politicians. Mm-hmm. Prior to that point, generally, Spanish politics were pretty stable. You had a left-wing party, the Socialist Party. You had a right-wing party, the Popular Party, kind of like in the U.S. And they both had the support of around about half of the population. And you would generally, you know, you go back and forth. One of them would rule a government, usually, or have a kind of a stable coalition with some of the smaller regional parties. Financial crisis hit. And not just one political party, but that whole mainstream politics was just discredited. They lost a whole, their popularity of both of those plummeted. And suddenly you have all of these new parties come along. Ciudadanos on the right, Unidas Podemos on the left, Vox, a far right party, entering Spain's parliament for the first time in its democratic history in those April elections. Then you've got just a whole load of division that came to the fore after that, with countries like or parts of the country like Catalonia wanting to split off and become its own country, and Catalan nationalists. And then this spreads more division, because the right-wing Catalan nationalists won't work with the right-wing anti-nationalists. And a lot of that whole tension stems from the financial crisis. Catalonia is rich, and they don't want their tax money going to pay for these impoverished nations. And when you look at some of the statistics, you can see why 10 years later this is still having a massive impact. You know, Spain's youth unemployment is over 30% still. So for young people between 15 and 25 that wanting a job, one in three can't find a job. And it's been like that for 10 years. Mm. It's a massive level of unemployment and just of an entire lost generation. And what I think that those statistics are hiding is the fact that because Spain is in the euro, there's also a whole lot of young people in Spain that looked for jobs in Spain, couldn't find them, and moved to another country. Mm-hmm. And you've seen this across Southern Europe, just this exodus of young people looking for work. Just by contrast, America's youth unemployment right now is just under 9%. So, you know, very different from what you're seeing in somewhere that's at least nominally prosperous. So you're seeing a complete discreditation that's lasted 10 years of Europe's established political classes. And these ungovernable countries and all of these elections, they're just symptoms of this deep dissatisfaction with standard politics, standard politicians, standard ways of doing things.
So if the dissatisfaction with standard politics is evident, where are those people going? You mentioned a few of the parties that have gained in stature as the traditionalist parties have lost. And how does that factor in, or how do you see that playing out, say, in the broader picture within Europe?
I think both within Spain and in the broader picture, there's a lot of agreement that things are wrong, that politicians are corrupt, that we don't trust politicians and political parties. There's not necessarily a lot of agreement, I think, on what the solutions are. Mm. In general, though, people are shifting to the extremes. It's people going from supporting left-wing parties to out-and-out socialist, out-and-out communist parties. It's people who are kind of center-right voters starting to go to further right, and in some cases even far right, even neo-Nazi parties, parties that perhaps before the 2008 financial crisis they probably wouldn't have even thought of going to. And migration is playing a big role as well in other European countries. I think that's a little bit less of an issue in Spain, though that's still why you saw Vox, this far-right party, come to the fore more recently. So really, I think it's making people question things that before 2008 they would not have questioned. Is even democracy the best way of doing things? Mm-hmm. This party that I have voted for all my life, well, actually, I think I'm going to leave and abandon them for a different party. So people are just open to change in a way that they weren't before. Now, they may not be sure exactly what that change looks like right now, but I think when they see change that works, they'll embrace that in a way that they wouldn't have before.
So looking at this from the standpoint of Bible prophecy, we do expect change on a revolutionary scale to take place within several European nations and broadly within Europe. Put what's happening here in that context.
Yeah, this is exactly in line with what we're expecting. Revelation chapter 17 is just one of the key scriptures of prophecy that we come to again and again when talking about Europe. And it says that Europe is that this modern Europe is going to return to its roots, the same kind of Holy Roman Empire that we've seen rise up in Europe repeatedly under men like Charlemagne in the Middle Ages and on into Napoleon and even Adolf Hitler. That's going to rise up again one more time. And it says that this modern resurrection is going to be led by 10 kings. And other scriptures like Daniel chapter 8 has passages that talk about one fierce king over all of them. But we're talking about kings. We're talking about an organization of Europe that's different to the way we have now. We're also talking about 10, they're not 10 liberal Democrats. This is an autocratic method of government. So when we're looking at Europe, the Bible is telling us there's going to be a massive change in the way Europe is run and organized and the type of leaders that we have. And we're seeing the financial crisis pave the way, the 2008 crisis paved the way for that. And one of the fascinating aspects of this is Herbert W. Armstrong, who ran the Plain Truth magazine, the predecessor to The Trumpet. He said in 1984, there's a great quote where he said a banking crisis in America could trigger these prophecies to be fulfilled, could trigger Europe to suddenly unite in this power that the Bible forecasts. And we're not all the way to that Revelation 17 power. Maybe there will be another financial crisis that will kind of kick it on even further. But we're certainly seeing that line of thinking being proven completely right, that there's some major changes that are still underway in Europe that have been kicked off by a financial crisis starting in America. And we're seeing now prophecies that were made thousands of years ago, prophecies that in these other European leaders, empires in the past have already been proven true. We're seeing them being started to be fulfilled just so regularly on our news, as we just see European country after European country go through this kind of financial or this kind of political crisis.
Where would you point a listener to for more information about this, Richard?
Well, the He Was Right booklet is a great summary of all of those different all of the different forecasts from Herbert W. Armstrong, and that will give you some of those contacts about his prophecy about a financial crisis and what will happen to Europe. And then maybe we'll put a link in the show notes as well to just an article talking more specifically about the political crises that we're seeing in Europe that you can go and take a look at.
Okay, thanks very much for that, Richard. There were a couple of revelations about hacking this week, including what's being called a stunning breach by Russia of some of the most sensitive work of the FBI. For this story, we'll go to Jeremiah Jacques.
Yes, this was a bombshell report that was published by Yahoo News on Monday, and it revealed that Russian operatives hacked into the FBI's communication system starting back in 2010 and lasting for apparently at least 2 years from that time. So this was all part of an effort by Russia to prevent the FBI from monitoring Russian spies on U.S. soil. As you said, the report calls this a stunning breach by the Russians against some of the U.S.'s most sensitive operations. And it says that the Russians were apparently able to decrypt certain secure communications used by the FBI, and they were able to track specific devices used by specific FBI agents. And there's apparently even evidence that the Russians were able to hack into some computers that were not connected to the internet. And I'll just read one section of this report that discusses the, I guess, just the impact of it. It says, quote, "These compromises gave Russian spies in American cities, including Washington, New York, and San Francisco, key insights into the location of undercover FBI surveillance teams and likely the actual substance of FBI communications. They provided the Russians opportunities to check on remote recording devices and even gather intelligence on their FBI pursuers." End quote. So I think it's not at all hyperbolic for Yahoo News to call this a stunning breach. And listeners may remember back in 2016 when the Obama administration kicked 35 Russian diplomats out of the U.S. and also shut down two Russian diplomatic facilities. At the time, President Obama said that that was in retaliation for Russia's meddling in the U.S. election. But this new report says that the move was also in large part, and maybe even primarily, because of this Russian hack on the FBI, which was conducted mainly from those two U.S.-based Russian facilities.
It seems like this is the type of headline that we see more and more, that with the more information that we put online, the more sensitive, the more vulnerable we make ourselves to these types of operations. And this wasn't even the only kind of high-profile hack that we learned about this week.
That's right. Yeah, there was an entirely separate report from the other side of the world, two different nations, but in many ways it's just another part of the same story. And that is that Australia concluded that China was behind a momentous hack on its parliament and on various political parties. Reuters broke this story on Sunday, and it's actually about a cyber attack that happened back in February and March. So the Australians have been investigating this for about 6 months now, and now they've concluded that it was the Chinese that breached the network of the parliament and also the ruling Labour Party and its coalition partner, and also the opposition, the ruling Liberal Party and the opposition Labor Party. So this means that the hackers had access to policy papers, including, you know, papers about the various prongs of Australia's foreign policy. The hackers had access to private email correspondence between these politicians and lawmakers and their staff members, and also to other citizens. And I think one notable part of this story is that even though this report has been published, the Australian government so far has stopped short of publicly accusing the Chinese of orchestrating this attack. So, you know, China is Australia's largest trading partner. They buy more than a third of all Australia's exports. China also sends about a million tourists and students to Australia every year. So the Aussies have not wanted to damage their economic relationship with China, but it was a serious attack, and I think Australia's reluctance to call China out on it shows just how dangerous it is to become economically kind of reliant on China. But yet, that's what we see so many nations doing.
So how does this factor into Bible prophecy?
Well, yes, it's clear that we are vulnerable. You know, the U.S., Australia, the nations of Israel, we are vulnerable in our governing bodies and our intelligence agencies, as these reports show, and also in our military matters. And this vulnerability is something that's been on the radar of Trumpet Editor-in-Chief Gerald Fleury for 25 years now. He first wrote about this in 1995, warning about how dangerous it is for America, and specifically the American military, to be dependent on computer systems that are vulnerable to enemy sabotage. In an article at that time, Mr. Fleury quoted an analyst named Joseph DeCourcy, and DeCourcy called this the Western world's Achilles heel. And then Mr. Fleury wrote, quote, America is the greatest superpower this world has ever known, but we have a very vulnerable point in our military, our own Achilles heel. It's so dangerous that I'm amazed it hasn't received more publicity. And Mr. Fleury said that studying into that reminded him of a prophecy in Ezekiel 7:14, which is mostly about the modern U.S. and U.K., and which includes Australia. And it says, they've blown the trumpet even to make all ready, but none goes to battle. So it's, you know, it's an alarming prophecy there. It's about a future time when military technology will have apparently been hijacked by enemies. And Mr. Fleury writes, quote, it seems everybody is expecting our people to go to battle, but the greatest tragedy imaginable occurs. Nobody goes to battle, even though the trumpet is blown. Will it be because of a computer terrorist? So I think the news this week about Russia hacking the FBI and about China hacking Australia there shows just how vulnerable many vital computer networks really are. And it shows that for the U.S., for Australia, for any nation that is reliant on these kind of systems, that Achilles heel can easily be pierced.
All right. Well, thank you for that. We will put a link to that article, America's Achilles Heel, in the show notes for the program today. We appreciate that, Jeremiah. If you thought the story about Supreme Court nominee and now Justice Brett Kavanaugh was over, the New York Times has news for you. Well, or maybe it's not really news after all, but to learn about this, we'll turn to Andrew Miller.
Yeah, on Sunday, the New York Times published an opinion piece highlighting some excerpts from a new book came out by two authors on Brett Kavanaugh, specifically another accusation of sexual harassment that allegedly happened when he was in college, that the FBI actually investigated a year ago during the nasty confirmation hearing that Mr. Kavanaugh went through. And by way of reminder, Brett Kavanaugh, he's a justice on the Supreme Court, nominated to the Supreme Court over a year ago, went through one of the nastiest confirmation hearings in American history with four different women coming out accusing him of rape and or sexual harassment in an attempt to keep him off the court. The FBI determined that at least two of those cases were outright lies because those women opposed his stance on abortion. And in the other two cases, they were accusations were unproved and probably unprovable. And so he took his seat on the court anyway. Looked like the story had died down until just this Sunday, New York Times comes out with this opinion piece on this book, just kind of dredging all these accusations back to the surface. Mm-hmm. In the book, it makes the case that the alleged victim in this so-called story doesn't even remember Kavanaugh being involved at all. But when the Times did their book review, they removed that acknowledgement that the victim doesn't remember this, and then never even contacted the accuser. It was another person, a man, who made the accusation that Kavanaugh did this. So they deliberately, or seemingly deliberately, removed the fact that the victim doesn't remember this, and then never contacted the accuser for clarification, which would seem to indicate that they're only trying to focus on the parts that make it look like Kavanaugh is guilty to push forward a political agenda without actually looking for the facts, and in some cases even suppressing those facts.
Yeah, this is essentially the guilty until proven innocent, and there's no way to really prove innocence in some of these things. But it seems like their overall strategy is to just cast enough doubt on Brett Kavanaugh that whatever decisions that he makes, that they're somehow illegitimate. I mean, I even heard people talking this week as if we still have to have doubts about any judgment from Clarence Thomas because of what happened when he was confirmed, what, 20 plus years ago.
Right. And actually, the lawyer for Christine Blasey Ford, she was the main accuser back a year ago. In April, actually, so this is a couple months back, even came out quite honest about that strategy, saying that he will always have an asterisk next to his name when he takes a scalpel to Roe versus Wade. We will know who he is. We will know his character. We will know what motivates him, and this is important. It is important to know, and this is part of what motivated Christine. So basically, this lawyer's even admitting that they had no proof to bring an actual legal case mm-hmm. against Kavanaugh. There was never maybe by smear campaign they could have kept him off the court, but even now that they haven't kept him off the court, she's saying this, like, well, just the fact that we made the accusation, whether or not you can prove it, you're trying to put this asterisk next to his name to do similar to you said with Clarence Thomas, that if they ever do have specifically an abortion case. I mean, there's a lot of conservatives want to overturn the Roe versus Wade court decision that made abortion basically a federal right. And so now you're going to, if that ever happens, you're going to have danger of civil disobedience.
Right.
And that you start talking about, like, well, this court case, I mean, it might be constitutional and it might be made by a majority of the court, but if you've got two justices on the court that have been accused falsely even of sexual harassment or rape, you, like I said, you've just put the asterisk on the name. So it's really about sowing doubt.
Mm-hmm. And it's really part of this general spirit that we've seen, and we've talked quite a bit about. Our editor-in-chief, Gerald Fleury, has drawn attention to, really, for the last two decades, this increasingly lawless spirit within the United States.
Right. We have an article we can put in the show notes from our editor-in-chief, Mr. Gerald Fleury, that is titled, The Kavanaugh Hearings Reveal America's Lawless Spirit. And in that article, it actually goes back even a little longer than two decades. I think it goes back about a little over three decades to the Robert Bork hearing, talking about they didn't accuse him of rape, but the similar, they were radical left was vehemently opposed to his constitutional stance on the abortion issue and made whatever false accusations they could to discredit him and keep him off the court. He has a quote in that article, Mr. Fleury does, that there is a force that values political power over truth, license over law, and in the Kavanaugh hearings, we got a good look at just how strong this force has become. He then goes on to explain that force is actually Satan, the devil, and even quoting Ephesians 2 and verse 1 through 2, where he says, you were dead in your trespasses and your sins, which you once walked, following the course of this world, following the prince of the power of the air, the spirit that now works in the sons of disobedience. And so obviously making up false accusations or even publicly going to these big media sources with smears on someone that can't be proved or there's no evidence from, I mean, that is a spirit of lies and falsehood that's stirring up protest. You saw a lot of that in the Kavanaugh hearings with just like people just trying to shout down the Senate hearing, that this lawless spirit of disobedience that works in the world.
Mm-hmm. The Kavanaugh hearings reveal America's lawless spirit. We'll put a link to that article from Gerald Fleury in the show notes. We appreciate you bringing that to us. Andrew, you're listening to Trumpet Hour. We're going to take a short break, but I want to point out another one of our programs here on Trumpet Radio. On this program, we talk a lot about world news in light of Bible prophecy. There's a whole lot more in the Bible than just prophecy. It's a book that tells us how to live. Trumpet Radio gives a very helpful, practical instruction on that in our program, Live by Every Word. This past week, host Dwight Falk did a program on what it means to be born again. It's a very important subject. There's a lot of confusion about. The answer is not what most people think. But you can find that program at kpcg.fm and also at thetrumpet.com under our Listen tab. Dwight does a very good job of proving these truths clearly and directly from your Bible. Next week, his program will discuss what the Bible reveals about what happens after you die. There's a lot of confusion about this. He's going to get specifically into the three resurrections mentioned in Revelation 20. So listen to Live by Every Word next week, and you'll get a biblical explanation of life after death. His program airs Mondays at 10 a.m. And then again, you can find that at thetrumpet.com. We will be right back.
This is the voice of the Trumpet News Magazine. You're listening to Trumpet Hour.
Though Israeli politics are up in the air, however that situation plays out, it appears U.S. President Donald Trump is prepared to show an unprecedented level of support for the Jewish state. For this story, we'll go back to Brent Nachtigall.
Yes, unprecedented is the right word, and we've talked about this over and over again, the number of gifts that this president of the United States has given to Israel over the past 2 years. And on the eve of the election, he gave forward another one, or at least potentially another one. He said this: I had a call today with Prime Minister Netanyahu to discuss the possibility of moving forward with a mutual defense treaty between the United States and Israel that would further anchor the tremendous alliance between our two countries. And so this has never happened before, this mutual defense treaty. In a way, this would allow a strike on Israel to mean that America would come to Israel's aid. Of course, that's kind of expected. But this would be a formal treaty that they would put through the whole Senate process as well in the end. And so this is something that's really interesting. I mean, they have tried to do this before numerous times, but different Israeli leaders and American leaders felt like this would really limit and impact their ability to act independently of one another. And there is some value to that. And yet here is a president that believes that the relationship with Israel right now is strong enough to the point that, and let's just say not just the relationship strong enough, but the interests are aligned to such a great degree that it seems like it would be a no-brainer to attach to Israel and America a similar defense treaty that the U.S. has with NATO and such.
President Trump made an interesting comment that suggested that this was after the election, that our relationship is not with the man Netanyahu, but it is with the nation Israel, seems to suggest that the way that he feels about the nation really is irrespective of who's in charge there. What's your sense of how much the personality matters as far as this goes?
I think the personality is a big thing. I think he is protecting himself. If Netanyahu lost, he doesn't know. Yep. It's a fait accompli. And he didn't say our relationship is not with Netanyahu. He said our relationship was with Israel. So It was, and you had the press in Israel just love that, just blasted it. Look at this. He doesn't really like Netanyahu. Yep. And so I think we can take it with a grain of salt in terms of, hey, it was right during an election. So he is going to say that. That would be the appropriate diplomatic thing to say, that, hey, our relationship was with Israel. It's stronger than that. But that said,
right,
I mean, you look at everything that's happened with the Golan Heights, moving the embassy, and this is right on the election eve. You're not going to come out and say, I had a call with Netanyahu, and say that you're, you know, just with Israel. He wanted this to help Netanyahu's election chances at getting in. And I think that's, you know, understandable because of the close relationship and the working relationship that they have had. Now, there are a couple of things to consider when of you know, the ramifications of such a mutual alliance. Is it just something to push Netanyahu over the line in the election? Or is it something that he's really considering being a strategic option for the United States in the Middle East to have Israel more firmly a part of the American-led alliance? And I think that Trump is looking forward to using Israel. For the past week, we've been talking about these attacks that Iran has had on Saudi Arabia and the lack of ability that the American military has to act without this hurting President Trump in the next American election, because he's broadly campaigned on the fact that he does not want to invest American soldiers in the Middle East anymore, foreign wars. And so really what a number of people are seeing with this is that this is a way of bringing Israel on side that they could somehow act in terms of American interests. Maybe they will attack Iran. Maybe they become so closely aligned with the United States that he can still save face by standing up to Iran through Israel's military, since they're already doing it so much. And I think Israel would want some pretty strong indications that if Israel did act against the Iranian mainland, that the United States would have Israel's back. And that isn't something that is set in stone. The United States has had a close relationship with Israel, but there are numerous times in Israel's history where the United States has not come through. The Yom Kippur War is one of them. Israel had to attack Syrian nuclear reactor, Iraqi nuclear reactors, 2007. The United States did not want that to happen. The nuclear deal in 2015, that was Israel's on the receiving end of Iran's wrath, and so that was an anti-Israel deal that America was for. So Israel is kind of thinking forward and projecting into the future that, you know, when Trump goes, we still have this thing that has been voted on by the Senate as well.
So just briefly to conclude, we alluded to it a bit in the first half, the alignment between America and Israel according to Bible prophecy, something that we would expect.
Yeah, and especially of late with Mr. Gerald Flurry talking about how President Trump does fulfill this end-time Jeroboam role that is prophesied in the book of Amos. And anciently, this was Jeroboam II. He lived in the 8th century. He was a very strong leader for Israel, expanding the borders of that country, the country all the way up into the north and to the east and to the west. But at the same time, you did have a strong king in southern Israel, southern Judah, in King Uzziah. And while the Bible doesn't necessarily say they were locked in an alliance, they couldn't have not been an alliance for both of these nations to grow so strongly. And so it really does imply, if we have this Jeroboam type, that we have another type in southern Israel that do work together to expand each other's interests, at least for a time. And that's what we see right now. This aligning of interests between the state of Israel and America, especially President Trump, is very plain and clear to see.
Mm-hmm. The work that is being done on our upcoming new magazine, Watch Jerusalem, there's an article in there by Brad McDonald that highlights a lot of the parallels between what's happened in Israel and the United States and draws attention to those that prophecy about the resurgence that's taking place within Israel. It's quite an interesting article that will be available here within the next few weeks. I guess the final touches are being put on that magazine. We'll look forward to seeing that when that comes online. We appreciate that very much, Brent. A couple weeks ago, we spoke about military drills in Asia that would include a huge number of nations under Russian leadership. Well, those drills are now underway. To learn about the details, we'll go back to Jeremiah Jacques.
Yes, Russia and China and India and Pakistan and Kazakhstan and Kyrgyzstan, Tajikistan and Uzbekistan.
Well done.
They're currently conducting these mass military drills in Russia. As you mentioned, we spoke a bit about this last month when the announcement about the drills was made, but now they are underway, taking place as we speak with, you know, troops marching, tanks rolling, aircraft flying, and even Russia's Iskander missiles screeching reaching through the skies there. These exercises begin on Monday at 8 different locations across central Russia. They're called Center. That's the name of the drills here. And they'll wrap up tomorrow. And the season for the Center drills actually began back in June. So what we're seeing now this week is basically just a culmination of those, what analysts call the hot phase of the military drills. And the numbers here show, I think, just how momentous these exercises are. Altogether, you have about 128,000 military personnel taking part from these 8 countries, and more than 20,000 weapons and pieces of military equipment involved, and 600 aircraft. So it's just some striking numbers of people and weaponry, I think, involved here.
When we spoke about this before, you were commenting about just how much the fact that Russia is the one that's uniting all of these nations, some of which are at odds with one another and have pretty significant differences, is it really quite significant from the standpoint of Bible prophecy, that Russia's the head.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Bible prophecy talks about an Asian power that will come together in the end time under Russian leadership. Ezekiel 38 is very clear that the head of this will be Russia, and even with Vladimir Putin or his office there heading that up. And the scriptures show that it will be larger than any military force in human history, with 200 million military personnel. And the scriptures actually get very specific about which nations will be under Russia's leadership there. That passage in Ezekiel 38 lists ancient names for China and India among those that'll take part. And when you consider just how vast the populations of those countries are, with each of them approaching 1.4 billion now, it's easy to see how, once you factor those into the equation, it would be very mathematically feasible to arrive at that 200 million number for the number of soldiers. So I think when we see China and India and Pakistan and all these other countries laying aside their differences with each other in order to practice for war shoulder to shoulder with each other under Russia's leadership, mm-hmm. it just really is laying the foundation for what the scriptures tell us to expect.
We have a trend article called Why the Trumpet Watches Russia Allying with China. These are really some of the most electrifying prophecies of the Bible that Jeremiah is talking about here. And I'd encourage you to go look at that article to get a better idea of what those prophecies say, what they forecast for the time ahead, and how we're seeing them take place. We're seeing them fulfilled right before our eyes. We'll put a link to that trend article in the show notes for the program today. Thanks for that, Jeremiah. Germany is also undertaking some military drills, or training drills anyway, in the Middle East. And its activities there have a particular resonance in light of biblical prophecy. For this story, we'll go back to Richard Palmer.
Yes, we're seeing a couple of interesting stories coming out of Germany in the Middle East. One of the most straightforward is that Germany announced that it would extend its army training mission in northern Iraq. The current deadline was set to expire soon. It will now be, the deadline is 31st of October 2020. They've got a mandate to have 700 troops in that area of northern Iraq and getting in close to Syria. There were some within Germany that wanted that mission over. Here you see all these headlines about Islamic State defeated, etc., and the whole rationale for that training mission was to train soldiers to fight as the Islamic State. But they're making sure that they're staying there even beyond that particular or that high profile battle. The other story that we've seen is just, I think it's kind of a fascinating one, which is Germany's relationship with Saudi Arabia. You know, we had those major, massive attacks from Iran on Saudi Arabia earlier in the week. Now, for the last year, Germany's had an arms embargo on Saudi Arabia. And there was a push from Angela Merkel's party, especially, to end that. That, you know, Saudi Arabia needs our help. They're under attack from Iran. We need to have a closer relationship with them. That push didn't go anywhere. They've extended those sanctions or that arms embargo for another 6 months. But at the same time, you look at the history of the arms embargo over the last year, and you can be sure Germany will find a way around it. So they've had this arms embargo for a year. However, what happened was, you know, Rheinmetall was selling a whole bunch of weapons to Saudi Arabia. Suddenly, they couldn't sell those weapons from Germany. So instead, Rheinmetall Italia started selling weapons to Saudi Arabia, which is just the Italian branch of the same country, of the same company. And then also, Rheinmetall has some deals with some South African countries. And So they started selling weapons to Saudi Arabia as well. So they just basically kept going, but did it via Italy and South Africa. Italy recently passed an arms embargo on Saudi Arabia, and South Africa is clamping down on that as well, which is why you saw so much pressure this month for Germany to open that back up again. They did open up a training mission where they're sending soldiers to train police forces and things like that over in Saudi Arabia. So as we see this deal go on for the next 6 months, I think it'll be also interesting to watch how Rheinmetall and some of these German arms companies gets around the extension of that embargo. Now, this relationship between Germany and the Middle East is a really important one to watch, because it's one the Bible forecasts specifically. Psalm chapter 83 talks about it talks about Assyria. It mentions Assyria by name, which you can prove is referring to Germany in Bible prophecy. They have a relationship with the Arab nations, and it talks about the descendants of Hagar, and it talks about the Arabians. So it's a relationship between Europe and the Middle East. It says that it's a military alliance, and so this alliance has never happened in all of history. It's a prophecy for the future, and that's what we're seeing develop now with Germany moving into the Middle East, with it developing its alliance with Saudi Arabia. Despite some public posturing, it puts a lot of importance on the practical, behind the scenes nature of that alliance. We have a story that goes into much more detail on this. It's a Trends article. It's called Why the Trumpet Watches: An Alliance Between Arab Nations and Europe, and it will show you how that this alliance was forecast in detail thousands of years ago.
Okay, thank you very much for that. Richard, one last story. Venezuela's former leader, Hugo Chavez, was very anti-American. He had several policies designed to hurt and weaken America. He died 6.5 years ago, but the policies continue from Venezuela to this day. For this story, we'll turn to Andrew Miller.
Yeah, the Wall Street Journal published some new U.S. government documents that it had been granted access to this week. That highlight the fact that before he died in 2005 specifically, Hugo Chavez ordered his top generals to work with communist insurgents in Colombia to smuggle cocaine into the United States, specifically for the purpose of weakening the United States from within. Now, the revelation that generals in Venezuela have been smuggling cocaine into the United States is not new. We've known that for years. It's called the Cartel of the Suns, based off the insignia that Venezuelan generals, they'd been providing support to the Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia, which is a Marxist group in that nation trying to overthrow the government, or was trying to overthrow the government at the time. And so the Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia put the cocaine into Venezuela, and then the Venezuelan government's trafficked it north. But these new documents by the Wall Street Journal highlight something that has long been suspected, that the generals weren't just doing this to line their pockets. It is obviously lucrative business for them, but there's an ideological component of these communists in Colombia and then these socialist generals in Venezuela working together to use cocaine as a weapon to weaken the United States from within. Yeah, and then this is definitely something that we've talked about on this program before, even highlighting verses like Hosea 7 verses 8 through 10, which talks about Ephraim, the tribe of Ephraim specifically, which refers to modern day Britain, though Mr. Herbert W. Armstrong has explained that verse in other contexts as Ephraim being the oldest birthright tribe, being like God's firstborn, as being a symbol for modern Israel in general. And this verse in Hosea 7 talks about Israel mixes itself with the peoples. Ephraim is a cake not turned. Strangers devour his strength, and he knows it not. And so this is this type of activity like you're seeing in Venezuela, where strangers or foreigners are covertly eating away at end times Israel's strength. We actually have an article we can put in the show notes, a new article from Mr. Stephen Fleury titled "You Can Conquer Addiction," that brings this down to a more personal level about the individual drug addiction and other addiction sins in Israel that allows things like this to happen, that enemies of America like Hugo Chavez and his successors in Venezuela can utilize to actually bring an entire nation down.
All right. Well, thank you for that, Andrew. I'm Joel Hilliker. That will do it for today's Trumpet Hour. You can email us your thoughts on the program to letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks to our panel, Jeremiah Jacques, Andrew Miller, Richard Palmer, and Brent Noctegal. Thanks to Jesse Hester for engineering and production. I'll leave you with the words of John Muir. No synonym for God is so perfect as beauty. Whether as seen carving the lines of the mountains with glaciers or gathering matter into stars or planning the movements of water or gardening, still all is beauty. Thanks for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Until next time, keep watching your world.
Been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio 101.3 KPCG and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.